Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. Day 5 of the Kevin McCarthy, Tucker Carlson, January 6th video scandal, and finally somebody has done something. The Department of Justice, Homeland Security, the Capitol Police Board, Democrats in the House, in the Senate, Paw Patrol?
Lindell TV is going after Kevin McCarthy and Congress. We're going after them because they did it wrong.
Yes, Mike Lindell has done something. Mike Lindell is suing. Mike Lindell is the one actually doing something about Kevin McCarthy and House Administration Chair Brian Stile lying to the Capitol Police in order to let Tucker Carlson and Fox News purloin 44,000 hours of security video in what Chuck Schumer called one of the worst security risks since 9/11. Skipping Lindell's mangled attempt to explain how his Equal Protection Clause and First Amendment rights have been violated, of course, Mike Lindell is entirely correct.
Fox News will get to put out whatever they see fit. And we're over here and we're not putting out that information, but we don't even know what they're filtering, Brandon. What's important to our news station here? Obviously, there's a lot of things not important to Fox News, right?
Lindell is looking at it from the other angle, that McCarthy has the right to unilaterally release this video. He just doesn't have the right to unilaterally release this video exclusively to Tucker Carlson. To me, that's debatable, or at best, the secondary point. But while I want everybody arrested and the access to the video halted and memories wiped, if that is really a thing, Greg Sargent from The Washington Post takes a slightly more practical approach, the same one Lindell just expressed. The easiest response from Democrats is not a series of legal actions, like I want, but to simply do what McCarthy did. Release the remaining January 6th video, but release it to everybody. Specifically to networks that could answer what Fox will do with the video to gaslight the coup attempt, by using the video to reinforce what actually happened, and by using the video to show how Carlson and Fox deceptively cherry-picked the footage. But is anybody looking at the larger picture? That you have just turned video of the Trump-Fox-Republican Party conspiracy to overthrow the government, You have just turned that video over to the Trump, Fox, Republican Party conspirators. Well, yes, somebody does see that. Lindell.
Fox is going to be the filter to the world and give them this stuff. Not going to happen on my watch, I'll tell you that.
Thanks to Ron Filipkowski and his exceptional Twitter feed for the audio from that noted liberal media outlet, Lindell TV. Lindell sues everybody else. 4-day work week. Capitol Police Chief Tom Manger's statement Monday, Schumer's statement Wednesday, news that much of the House Democrats' internal meeting about McCarthy's criminal deviousness and the risk he just subjected every member of Congress and the Senate, and indeed the citizenry too, was led by the chair of the disbanded January 6th committee, Benny Thompson, and Benny Thompson's concerns echo those of Schumer about putting the people inside the Capitol at risk. A lot of statements. No, you know, actions. And no putting the pieces together that as egregious as this illegal collusion between Kevin McCarthy and Tucker Carlson is in terms of security, it's not just lives that are at risk. Tucker Carlson will pervert this video in order to use it to support his lie that January 6th was something else. Believe whatever you want as that something else, as long as you doubt the government, as long as you salute the false flag. Whether or not Tucker Carlson believes Antifa did it, or Biden, or the Trilateral Commission, or as the Dominion text shows, as usual, he's not actually a psychotic conspiracy theorist. He just plays one on TV. The video is not there to provide sunshine, as McCarthy and that nitwit Nancy Mace so moronically phrased it. The video is there to provide a different kind of illumination. Gaslight. Whatever does or does not happen out of the special counsel's office, the point of the next 20 months for Trump and his insurrectionist mob is to make the guilty look innocent and the innocent look guilty, and moreover, to make the investigators look guilty. Poison the prosecutorial well. It has so far worked spectacularly for Donald Trump. In almost any other era of American history, he would long ago have been imprisoned or have fled the country, or worse. But in literally the days after the coup attempt, Trump inspired and shaped, Trump was suddenly being defended by vermin like Kevin McCarthy. McCarthy went from suggesting Trump should resign the presidency that night to fulsomely thanking him and groveling to him by name 2 years to that night later, when his succession of deals with sundry devils got him elected Speaker of the House. One of those devils was Tucker Carlson, and now McCarthy has just paid him his due. And the video will not just be used as part of the grand excuse by Trump cultists when they believe or pretend to believe that January 6th was Pelosi's fault or the FBI's fault or your fault. The video will be used as yet another arm of an octopus of revenge, threat, and retaliation. And while the Tucker Carlson crime story stalled yesterday, a new and nauseating story emerged. This one is about a dark money group called American Accountability Foundation, AAF. And last night, Politico reported that this AAF has sent out a letter to hundreds of recipients on Capitol Hill, mostly in government, some outside it, the letter designed to wreak revenge on staffers who worked on the House January 6th committee. Quoting this letter, AAF has put together a cheat sheet outlining their new firms and the firm's clients, so you can be sure you and your staff aren't inadvertently taking a meeting with a company that hires staff that hates your boss. It is important to remember that even one of these former J6 investigators is not listed as a lobbyist on this specific account. The billings brought in by the clients listed below benefit all staff at the J6 investigators' new firm, unquote. translation, if you dared to investigate Trump on behalf of the United States Congress, and you dared to investigate sedition, and you dared to investigate treason, this AAF group will not merely try to blacklist you. It will intend to blacklist your new employer, and it hopes to blacklist your new employer's clients. The letter also invites recipients to let AAF know if AAF left anybody off the list. Politico notes AAF was co-founded by one Thomas Jones, a former Ted Cruz presidential campaign staffer, and thus obviously a man certainly embittered enough to last the rest of his life. AAF has also been linked by reporting in The New Yorker to the American Accountability Foundation and something called the Conservative Partnership Institute, which is itself connected to Cleta Mitchell and Mark Meadows. It's the blacklist method of the 1950s, except the smearing can be done now not just by an elected McCarthy, but also by a television channel that has completely untethered itself from the most elementary journalistic standards, yet is perceived by its audience as not just accurate, but principled. The sole limitation on Fox News' effectiveness in turning the real into the unbelievable and the unbelievable into the real is the short attention span of its viewers. In order to be able to pay attention to the propaganda, they need a constant churn of new outrages on Fox. And now, Kevin McCarthy has given Tucker Carlson 44,000 hours of raw propaganda from which he can choose anything and which he can alter to, quote, prove, unquote, anything. And as of this hour, with the Capitol Police Board and DOJ and DHS and Schumer and Jeffries and everybody else who should be doing something but are in fact all AWOL, the only thing standing between McCarthy and Brian Stile and Carlson and this mother load of 44,000 hours of raw, unprocessed brainwash is the diligence and the proactivity of one lone gallant man, Mike Lindell. We are so screwed. Still ahead of us in this edition of Countdown, George Santos is back, co-sponsoring legislation to honor a gun. Turns out he's lying about that, too. The Alaska legislator, who you heard here actually claiming it's better for society when victims of child abuse in Alaska are killed, gets a slap on the wrist. Should we retroactively edit the words of a dead author to make it easier to sell his books in the 21st century? The author is the creator of Willy Wonka. His name was Roald Dahl, and not only is this a huge issue, but when I was a kid, Roald Dahl and I corresponded. And on Fridays with Thurber, his story that basically prophesied the coming of Trump, the darkly comic, the greatest man in the world. That's next. This is Countdown.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
We When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Countdown with, Keith Olbermann.
Ahead, the Roald Dahl controversy. 60 years ago, Dahl used words like fat in his kids' book, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The publisher is now taking them out in hopes of selling more copies of Willy Wonka. I actually have personal experience with two parts of this story, and I've been privileged to edit for Taste, the works of a truly great writer. And I actually used to correspond when I was a kid with Roald Dahl. Ahead. First, time for the daily round of the miscreants, morons, and Dunning-Kruger effect specimens who constitute today's worst persons in the world. The bronze: Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and his press secretary, Brian Griffin. Yes, Brian Griffin, like the name of the dog on Family Guy. Griffin and his boss are apparently deep into an appendage-swinging contest with NBC News. Quoting Griffin, to all the bookers and producers reaching out to our office from NBC News and MSNBC, for Governor Ron DeSantis to join your shows, this will be the standard response from our office until Andrea Mitchell apologizes and your track record improves. I think we need to take a step back. There will be no consideration of anything related to NBC Universal or its affiliates until and at least Andrea Mitchell... Wait, what does that mean? Until and at least... Did this kid mean until and unless? Until and at least Andrea Mitchell corrects the blatant lie she made about the governor. DeSantis says that slavery and the aftermath of slavery should not be taught to Florida school children. Blah, 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 blah. Please feel free to pass this up and around the network. So Ron DeSantis and his press secretary are being snowflakes about Andrea Mitchell? 76-year-old Andrea Mitchell, who fell asleep while live on MSNBC the other day? Governor's campaign for president's going to be an awfully short one if you have to keep drying his tears about Andrea Mitchell, for God's sakes. Our runners-up, Alaska State Legislator David Eastman. He has now been censured for... Well, you heard this. I played it the other day.
In the case where child abuse is fatal, obviously it's not good for the child, but it's actually a benefit to society because there aren't needs for government services and whatnot over the whole course of that child's life.
Through the chair, can you say that again? Did you say a benefit for society?
Talking dollars. Now, you've got a $1.5 million price tag here for victims of fatal child abuse. It gets argued periodically that it's actually a cost savings because that child is not going to need any of those government services that they might otherwise be entitled to receive and need based on growing up in this type of environment.
Through the chair, Representative, I guess that would be the idea, if I can use a really bad analogy, when you hit somebody.
Yeah, he actually said that during a hearing at the Alaska State Legislature. So he was censured, and that's two censures now for Representative Eastman, who was also at a Trump rally in D.C. on January 6, 2021. The vote on this censure was 35 in favor and one against, and the one vote against was by Eastman. But our winners, Congressman Barry Moore and George Santos. Moore of Alabama introduced, and Santos is now signed on as co-sponsor of, a bill to declare the AR-15 the national gun of America. You know the AR-15, the current slogan for which is, 1,000 mass murderers can't be wrong. Apart from the cynical death cult issue here, there's something about the AR-15 Moore and Santos don't know. It was designed and for decades sold exclusively by Colt Firearms. Colt Firearms, which in 2021 was sold to a company based in Prague. So the gun Moore and this pathetic Santos want to call the national gun of America is Czech. Congressman Barry Moore and George Santos, and you know what you can do with those AR-15 lapel pins, boys. Today's worst persons in the world! Postscripts to the news, some headlines, some updates, some snark, some predictions. Well, just one headline this time. Please tell me where to send my Roald Dahl letters so they can be sanitized for my protection. If the name Roald Dahl does not immediately ring a bell for you, he was the author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and thus the creator of Willy Wonka, and he wrote James and the Giant Peach, and all of his kids' books combined have sold about 250 million copies. Dead since 1990, 2 years ago, Forbes placed Dahl first on its list of the top-earning dead celebrities, ahead of Prince and Michael Jackson. Roald Dahl made about $513 million in 2021, compared to $13 million by the late John Lennon. And that is where the problems began. And if you have not heard about the problems, the first is Roald Dahl was often, as somebody on Twitter put it succinctly, he was often the C word. He was at times anti-Semitic, racist, misogynistic, and cruel. And his writing was at times anti-Semitic, racist, misogynistic, and cruel. None of that has ever really slowed down his book sales, though, largely because, first, kids who read books are actually smarter than nearly every adult thinks they are, and second, it seemed then and now that the more problematic a lot of Dahl's characters were, the smarter he made them. The Oompa Loompas of Willy Wonka are not Dahl's finest moments. On the other hand, they do run everything in the chocolate factory. They know everything about the ticket-winning kids and their foibles. And when Violet turns into a giant blueberry, and when Veruca gets devoured by squirrels, it is the Oompa Loompas who know how to save them. So apparently the Oompa Loompas are doctors, or at least paramedics. Anyway, the reason Roald Dahl made $513 million 31 years after he died was that his estate sold the rights to the books to Netflix. By then, the book publishers had already brought in a company of so-called sensitivity readers to rewrite the more troublesome parts of Dahl's work. We're seeing the first results of this now, and it is literally what George Orwell described in his novel 1984, erasing the past, replacing it with a new past, and leaving no indication that any editing or changing was done. While I'm assuming it still says that in 1984, presumably all of that could be edited out of Orwell and we'd never know, right? But it's even worse than that, because the edits are being made not because of some pure, if misguided, desire to make changes reflecting the changes in mores and respect, changes even the author might want to make. They're being done so that the books, according to the publisher, can continue to be enjoyed by all today, meaning they did this to literally sell more books. This is not even about well-intentioned censorship, it's about profit. And if all that were not bad enough, the rewriting of Roald Dahl has, from a quality viewpoint, gone about as well as the so-called restoration of the painting of Jesus in Spain in 2012. The painting is now known as Monkey Christ or Potato Jesus. Apart from the wholesale elimination of words like fat and ugly, the publishers have decided to take out references that no kid would ever notice. She went to India with Rudyard Kipling becomes she went to California with John Steinbeck. Why? In his story, The Witches, Roald Dahl has the hero believe that all witches are bald and wear wigs and gloves, and that's a way to check. Don't be foolish, my grandmother said. You can't go around pulling the hair of every lady you meet, even if she is wearing gloves. Just you try it and see what happens. That would be an admonition not to believe that everybody with a wig is a witch. It has now been changed to, don't be foolish, my grandmother said. Besides, there are plenty of other reasons why women might wear wigs, and there is certainly nothing wrong with that. It's like Shakespeare now. Look, it is one thing if you are giving a public reading of Tom Sawyer, and you may want to drop a couple of words here and there. I have performed James Thurber's stories since 2010. On TV, on radio, on this podcast, in person. His epic story, by the way, forecasting Trump, the greatest man in the world, is coming up shortly. Thurber's daughter, Rosie, offered me the right to edit anything I felt I needed to edit for time or for taste, and said there was plenty in there her dad would be mortified by today that he wrote. Letting me edit it, though, was like saying, hey, you have a heart, so that means you can perform heart surgery. But the goal in doing that is to change as little as possible. There are adjectives that were once perfectly normal and seemingly liberal and once thought even to be complimentary that you really need to just skip. So when you're reading them aloud, just skip them. But erase them permanently forever from Thurber's books when maybe a note to new readers would be sufficient warning? Plus, if I'm changing anything about Thurber while transforming his work into a different medium, like podcasts, I am necessarily going to edit things. A movie might leave out 9/10 of any novel, but just reading a novel aloud might change something as important as the emphasis on the way certain words were said from the way the author intended that emphasis to be. Besides which, all those changes are temporary. I'm not altering Thurber's text. I'm altering my reading of his text. And the same goes for Roald Dahl. And a lot of people saying this are people who do not like Roald Dahl. Sir Salman Rushdie wrote, he was a self-confessed anti-Semite with pronounced racist leanings, and he joined in the attack on me back in 1989. Roald Dahl was no angel, but this is absurd censorship. Puffin Books and the Dahl estate should be ashamed. Because that's the point. If we're going to edit or otherwise circumscribe every book or author or film or producer with a significant problem, we're going to wind up with a world library of about 50 books and 10 films. I mean, this isn't Florida. And artists, like people, are rarely all good or all bad, and often they have huge, disturbing flaws, which can, in their own way, teach you what not to do or be in life. The publishers defended doing this on the premise that Roald Dahl's works have always been edited and modified, that he permanently changed the description of those Oompa Loompas several times to make it less offensive. And again, that misses the point. He made those changes, not his publishers, not his literary estate, not you, not me, him. And if you're wondering why I'm going on so long about this, it's because this is personal for me. I think I learned that truth, that almost everybody is a mix of good and bad, often in big, bright, ugly letters, often with extraordinary self-contradictions. I learned all that from Roald Dahl. Sometime in the second half of March 1966, a letter unlike any other I had seen before arrived at our little house in the suburbs of New York City, where my parents packed me off each morning to the third grade. The words par avion were printed in the upper left, and the postmark was from somewhere called Great Missenden, and the addressee was me. It was a letter from Roald Dahl. I had a number of very special teachers in my life, but the first of them was Mrs. Marjorie Plant, who survived an entire school year of me in 1965 and 1966. We sidled down the hallway to Miss Ritz for an hour or so of math every day, but the rest of the time, we were Mrs. Plant's class. And when she was not leading us out to the glorious natural meadow and the pond just behind the elementary school and teaching us the name of every plant and every tree and every bird, she was reading to us or getting us to read to her, or one day asking each of us to name our favorite author. Well, I didn't hesitate. My dad read to me each night, and it's probable somebody else's book was first, and I know he later read me Chitty Chitty Bang Bang by Ian Fleming. But the first books for me were Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach by Roald Dahl, and I don't know how many times Dad read each of them to me, but I do know that somehow those books conveyed to me that books didn't just happen, that a grown-up, like my dad, had written them deliberately for kids to read and to listen to. And this man had clearly included jokes that the kids would get, but the grown-ups didn't seem to notice. And this was this man's job, the way being a draftsman and later an architect was my dad's job, that you could do this and people would pay you. This is how I understood about this. 1,000 other writers and broadcasters fleshed out the details and the specifics for me, but the man who opened the first door into the world in which perhaps I could write for a living was Roald Dahl. So, Keith, who's your favorite author? Mrs. Plant asked. Roald Dahl, Mrs. Plant. Knowing her and knowing me, she probably said, I knew it. And soon after, she explained that we had an assignment that day. We were all going to write. Great, I thought. I'll write another book. I had already written something like 40 books in Mrs. Plant's class, 2 or 3 pages, with illustrations, with construction paper covers, with staples, with titles. I wasn't just going to be a writer like Roald Dahl. I already was one. Not a book today, Keith, she said. I want you all to write a letter to your favorite author. I know how to get your letters to your author, so you don't have to worry about that part. You can ask them anything you want in the letter. You can tell them anything about yourself. But I especially want you to tell them why you like their books and who you are and how old you are. And on that day in March 1966, my favorite author had written me back. I had a sense immediately of it being a special occasion. I believe only one author besides Roald Dahl replied to anybody in our class. I do know the school thought it was a big enough deal to call the town newspaper to do a story on it. It's not as if I forgot the story or the letter or the sense of wonder at its arrival either, but despite the coverage in the weekly Hastings News, it still seemed like a very private family kind of thing. And then in 2010, somebody told me, maybe it was the publisher, that the private family thing had made it into the authorized biography of Roald Dahl, a book called Storyteller by Donald Sturrock. He wrote this next part. I did not. I think it's okay for me to bother it here. Quoting Mr. Sturrock, his stories were encouraging children the world over to read books, and that many of them loved his stories so much that they felt impelled to write and tell him so. The current rate of letters from children in the U.S. is between 50 and 60 a week, he had written to Mike Watkins in 1966. I try to answer them all with a postcard. Roald was always a diligent and engaging correspondent, and if he was in the right mood and thought a child's letter particularly imaginative, he or she would receive a fuller and more memorable response. When the sports journalist and television anchorman Keith Olbermann was 7 years old and head of maps in his class at school, he wrote to Dahl from Hastings-on-Hudson in New York and told him at some length about his own writing ambitions and successes. Roald's reply was thoughtful, generous, and full of gentle, ironic humor. My dear Keith, he began, it was wonderful to receive a letter from a fellow author. It meant so much more than the usual ordinary message from a mere reader. As head of maps, you will be able to calculate very easily what a long way your letter had to travel in order to reach me in this little village, thousands of miles. The postman, an elderly fellow who comes on foot, knocked on the door this morning and said, I have a letter from you from K. Olbermann of Hastings, USA. I said, how do you know? He said, it says so on the envelope. He is a very inquisitive postman, and he likes to know who is writing to me. Who is Olbermann? Asked the postman. I opened the letter and read it. "He is a writer," I said. "He has written more books than me." Olderman's parents later told the local newspaper that the letter had given the boy the kick of his young life. Mrs. Olderman added that it just about proves that there are still some very nice people left in this old beat-up world. If all adults acted with such loving attention to children, would it not be wonderful? Dahl was quite sincere when he argued that he thought children alone were decent judges of whether a book written for them was any good or not. In 1962, he had written to a child critic of James and the Giant Peach to tell him that, up to now, a whole lot of grown-ups have written reviews, but none of them have really known what they were talking about, because a grown-up talking about a children's book is like a man talking about a woman's hat. The author, Mr. Sturrock, not only put me in the authorized biography of Roald Dahl, he also put me in the index. There I am, right between David Ogilvy, the advertising legend, and Sir Laurence Olivier. Left out of Sturrock's account and the quotes from my mother was the fact that Mom was a fan of the actress Patricia Neal, Roald Dahl's wife, and she had read horror stories about their marriage and about Neal's stroke and Dahl's tough love during her recovery. As I began to appreciate her point of view and Dahl's books at the same time and his letter to me, I began to formulate a theory that not everybody was just one thing, that you could be good and bad and shouldn't be judged on just half of yourself. Naturally, I wrote my new pen pal back. He had mentioned having a son about my age. In fact, Theo Dahl had been born in New York, just like I was. But at the age of 4 months, in his baby carriage, Theo was hit by a cab, and his injuries were so profound that for a while he was blind. And Roald Dahl himself had helped to develop a shunt used to drain swelling in Theo's brain to make his life better and more worthwhile. I did not know any of this when I mentioned, among other mundane details, that a 7-year-old was likely to tell an adult in a letter that my middle name was Theodore. I also apparently included some poems I had written. And I know this because, sure enough, Roald Dahl wrote back again. This next letter did not come for nearly a year. "My dear Keith," it begins, dated February 2nd, 1967, "your last letter was a very good one. So were the poems." Imagine the impact of that from your favorite writer right after your 8th birthday. "But," Dahl went on, "I hope you will not become a poet when you grow up, because poets have a terribly hard time earning a living. I am writing a musical film," he went on, "for Dick Van Dyke, based roughly on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, The Flying Motor Car." Could I have mentioned liking this book by a different author in my letter to him? Or did he just decide to announce it to me? "We'll be making it here in England next summer, and you can go and see it in 1968 when you are 9 years old. You will be impressed at the things this car is going to do. With love, from Roald Dahl." I'm sure I wrote again. I can almost remember. He did not write back. I do not recall holding it against him, nor do I now. I do recall that when I followed his instructions and went to see his movie, I think, in fact, it was my 10th birthday party in early 1969, I was disappointed. Too much girl chasing, not enough car flying. Still, almost no one is all good or all bad, and every new reissue of every Roald Dahl book could include a 20-page treatise about what was bad about him and the negativities in that book and his other writings, just so long as it is included instead of, rather than in addition to, the nonsensical rewrites that Puffin Publishing has produced. Also, I think it might be appropriate to mention that, though the letters from kids just in the U.S., just in 1966, totaled around, what, 2,500? He tried to answer them all with a postcard. Or, if you were very lucky, a letter. Or, if you were very, very lucky, 2 letters, and a mention 43 years later in his official biography.
Hey.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Still ahead on Countdown, Fridays with Thurber, and somebody once described the work of James Thurber as optimistic cynicism. This week's story ain't that optimistic. Maybe his darkest and certainly his most prescient piece, The Greatest Man in the World. First, in each edition of Countdown, we feature a dog in need. You can help. Every dog has its day. To Brooklyn and Ben. Ben was a stray, picked up and brought to the New York Pound a week ago today, 1 week, and they are already ready to kill him. He's a 2-year-old shepherd mix. He was starving. He has a heart murmur. He's terrified, and surprisingly enough, he was growling and snarling, but he was also taking treats gently, and he clearly knows his commands. Model citizen? Maybe not. Should he die because he was a stray after 1 week? No. We can help defray the costs for a rescue to get Ben out and train him. If you can pledge some money, you will find Ben on my Twitter feeds. Your retweets will also help. I thank you, and Ben thanks you. To the Master, the work of James Thurber. There is a short film of this story. I don't think it really does it justice. I don't think anything does it justice. Occasionally, real life does do it justice. I've thought I've seen this story playing out in real time in this country almost every day for about 7 years. Sit back and relax, if relax is the right word for it. For The Greatest Man in the World by James Thurber. Looking back on it now from the vantage point of 1940, one can only marvel that it had not happened long before it did. The United States of America had been, ever since Kitty Hawk, blindly constructing the elaborate petard by which sooner or later it must be hoisted. It was inevitable that someday there would come roaring out of the skies a national hero of insufficient intelligence, background, and character, successfully to endure the mounting orgies of glory prepared for aviators who stayed up for a long time or flew a great distance. Both Lindbergh and Byrd, fortunately for national decorum and international amity, had been gentlemen. So had our other famous aviators. They wore their laurels gracefully, withstood the awful weather of publicity, married excellent women, usually fine family, and quietly retired to private life and the enjoyment of their varying fortunes. No untoward incidents on a worldwide scale marred the perfection of their conduct on the perilous heights of fame. The exception to the rule was, however, bound to occur. And it did, in July 1937, when Jack Pal Smirch, erstwhile mechanic's helper, in a small garage in Westfield, Iowa, flew a second-hand, single-motored, Bresthaven Dragonfly 3 monoplane all the way around the world without stopping. Never before in the history of aviation had such a flight as Smirch's even been dreamed of. No one had even taken seriously the weird floating auxiliary gas tanks, invention of the mad New Hampshire professor of astronomy, Dr. Charles Lewis Gresham, upon which Smirch placed full reliance. When the garage worker, a slightly built, surly, unprepossessing young man of 22, appeared at Roosevelt Field early in July 1937, slowly chewing a great quid of scrap tobacco, and announced, "Nobody ain't seen no flying yet." The newspapers touched briefly and satirically upon his projected 25,000-mile flight. Aeronautical and automotive experts dismissed the idea curtly, implying that it was a hoax, a publicity stunt. The rusty, battered, second-hand plane wouldn't go. The Gresham auxiliary tanks wouldn't work. It was simply a cheap joke. Smirch, however, after calling on a girl in Brooklyn who worked in the flap-folding department of a large paper box factory, a girl whom he later described as his sweet patootie, climbed nonchalantly into his ridiculous plane at dawn of the memorable 7th of July, 1937, spit a curve of tobacco juice into the still air, and took off, carrying with him only a gallon of bootleg gin and 6 pounds of salami. When the garage boy thundered out over the ocean, the papers were forced to record in all seriousness that a mad, unknown young man, his name was variously misspelled, had actually set out upon a preposterous attempt to span the world in a rickety one-engine contraption, trusting to the long-distance refueling device of a crazy schoolmaster. When 9 days later, without having stopped once, the tiny plane appeared above San Francisco Bay, headed for New York, spluttering and choking to be sure, but still magnificently and miraculously aloft, the headlines, which long since had crowded everything else off the front page, even the shooting of the governor of Illinois by the Valletti gang, swelled to unprecedented size, and the news stories began to run to 25 and 30 columns. It was noticeable, however, that the accounts of the epoch-making flight touched rather lightly upon the aviator himself. This was not because the facts about the hero as a man were too meager, but because they were too complete. Reporters, who had been rushed out to Iowa when Smirch's plane was first sighted over the little French coast town of Sailly-le-Mer to dig up the story of the great man's life, had promptly discovered that the story of his life could not be printed. His mother, a sullen short-order cook in a shack restaurant on the edge of a tourist's camping ground near Westfield, met all inquiries as to her son with an angry, "Ah, the hell with him. I hope he drowns." His father appeared to be in jail somewhere for stealing spotlights and lap robes from tourists' automobiles. His young brother, a weak-minded lad, had but recently escaped from the Preston, Iowa reformatory and was already wanted in several western towns for the theft of money order blanks from post offices. these alarming discoveries were still piling up at the very time that Pal Smirch, the greatest hero of the 20th century, blear-eyed, dead for sleep, half-starved, was piloting his crazy junk heap high above the region in which the lamentable story of his private life was being unearthed, headed for New York and a greater glory than any man of his time had ever known. The necessity for printing some account in the papers of the young man's career and personality had led to a remarkable predicament. It was, of course, impossible to reveal the facts, for a tremendous popular feeling in favor of the young hero had sprung up like a grass fire when he was halfway across Europe on his flight around the globe. He was, therefore, described as a modest chap, taciturn, blonde, popular with his friends, popular with girls. The only available snapshot of Smirch, taken at the wheel of a phony automobile in a cheap photo studio at an amusement park, was touched up so that the little vulgarian looked quite handsome. His twisted leer was smoothed into a pleasant smile. The truth was, in this way, kept from the youth's ecstatic compatriots. They did not dream that the Smirch family was despised and feared by its neighbors in the obscure Iowa town, nor that the hero himself, because of numerous unsavory exploits, had come to be regarded in Westfield as a nuisance and a menace. Pal Smirch had, the reporters discovered, once knifed the principal of his high school. Not mortally, to be sure, but he had knifed him. And on another occasion, surprised in the act of stealing altar cloth from a church, he had bashed the sexton over the head with a pot of Easter lilies. For each of these offenses, he had served a sentence in the reformatory. Inwardly, the authorities, both in New York and in Washington, prayed that an understanding providence might, however awful such a thing seemed, bring disaster to the rusty, battered plane and its illustrious pilot, whose unheard-of flight had aroused the civilized world to hosannas of hysterical praise. The authorities were convinced that the character of the renowned aviator was such that the limelight of adulation was bound to reveal him to all the world as a congenital hooligan, mentally and morally unequipped to cope with his own prodigious fame. "I trust," said the Secretary of State at one of the many secret cabinet meetings called to consider the national dilemma, "I trust that his mother's prayer will be answered," by which he referred to Mrs. Emma Smirch's wish that her son might be drowned. It was, however, too late for that. Smirch had leaped the Atlantic and then the Pacific as if they were mill ponds. At 3 minutes after 2 o'clock on the afternoon of July 17th, 1937, the garage boy brought his idiotic plane into Roosevelt Field for a perfect three-point landing. It had, of course, been out of the question to arrange a modest little reception for the greatest flyer in the history of the world. He was received at Roosevelt Field with such elaborate and pretentious ceremonies as rocked the world. Fortunately, however, the worn and spent hero promptly swooned, had to be removed bodily from his plane, and was spirited from the field without having opened his mouth once. Thus, he did not jeopardize the dignity of his first reception, a reception illumined by the presence of the Secretaries of War and the Navy, Mayor Michael J. Moriarty of New York, the Premier of Canada, Governors Fannimon, Groves, McFeely, and Critchfield, and a brilliant array of European diplomats. Smirch did not, in fact, come to in time to take part in the gigantic hullabaloo arranged at City Hall for the next day. He was rushed to a secluded nursing home and confined in bed. It was 9 days before he was able to get up, or to be more exact, before he was permitted to get up. Meanwhile, the greatest minds in the country in solemn assembly had arranged a secret conference of city, state, and government officials, which Smirch was to attend for the purpose of being instructed in the ethics and behavior of heroism. On the day that the little mechanic was finally allowed to get up and dress, and for the first time in 2 weeks took a great chew of tobacco, he was permitted to receive the newspaper men, this by way of testing him out. Smirch did not wait for questions. "Use guys!" he said, and the Times man winced. "Use guys can tell a cockeyed world.
that I put it over on Lindbergh, see? Yeah, made an ass of them two frogs.
The two frogs was a reference to a pair of gallant French flyers who, in attempting a flight only halfway around the world, had 2 weeks before unhappily been lost at sea. The Times man was bold enough at this point to sketch out for Smirch the accepted formula for interviews in cases of this kind. He explained that there should be no arrogant statements belittling the achievements of other heroes, particularly heroes of foreign nations.
"Ah, to hell with that," said Smirch. "I did it, see? I did it, and I'm talking about it."
And he did talk about it. None of this extraordinary interview was, of course, printed. On the contrary, the newspapers, already under the disciplined direction of a secret directorate created for the occasion and composed of statesmen and editors, gave out to a panting and restless world that Jackie, as he had been arbitrarily nicknamed, would consent to say only that he was very happy and that anyone could have done what he did. "My achievement has been, I fear, slightly exaggerated," the Times man's article had him protest with a modest smile. These newspaper stories were kept from the hero, a restriction which did not serve to abate the rising malevolence of his temper. The situation was indeed extremely grave, for Pal Smirch was, as he kept insisting,
"raring to go."
He could not much longer be kept from a nation clamorous to lionize him. It was the most desperate crisis the United States of America had faced since the sinking of the Lusitania. On the afternoon of the 27th of July, Smirch was spirited away to a conference room in which were gathered mayors, governors, government officials, behaviorist psychologists, and editors. He gave them each a limp, moist paw and a brief, unlovely grin.
"Hiya,"
he said. When Smirch was seated, the mayor of New York arose and, with obvious pessimism, attempted to explain what he must say and how he must act when presented to the world, ending his talk with a high tribute to the hero's courage and integrity. The mayor was followed by Governor Fannimon of New York, who, after a touching declaration of faith, introduced Cameron Spottiswood, second secretary of the American Embassy in Paris, the gentleman selected to coach Smirch in the amenities of public ceremonies. Sitting in a chair with a soiled yellow tie in his hand and his shirt open at the throat, unshaved, smoking a rolled cigarette, Jack Smirch listened with a leer on his lips.
I getcha,
he cut in nastily.
"You want me to act like a softy, huh? You want me to act like that mebbity-mebbity baby-face Lindbergh, huh? Well, nuts to that, see?"
Everyone took in his breath sharply. It was a sigh and a hiss. "Mr. Lindbergh," began a United States senator, purple with rage, "and Mr. Bird," Smirch, who was paring his nails with a jackknife, cut in again.
"Boyd," he exclaimed, "oh, for God's sake, that big—"
Somebody shut off the blasphemies with a sharp word. A newcomer had entered the room. Everyone stood up except Smirch, who was still busy with his nails, and he did not even glance up. "Mr. Smirch," said someone sternly, "the President of the United States." It had been thought that the presence of the chief executive might have a chastening effect on the young hero, and the former had been, thanks to the remarkable cooperation of the press, secretly brought to the obscure conference room. A great, painful silence fell. Smirch looked up, waved a hand at the president.
"How you coming?"
he asked, and began rolling a fresh cigarette. The silence deepened. Someone coughed in a strained way.
"Geez, it's hot, ain't it?"
said Smirch. He loosened two more shirt buttons, revealing a hairy chest and the tattooed word Sadie enclosed in a stenciled heart. The great and important men in the room, faced by the most serious crisis in American history, exchanged worried frowns. Nobody seemed to know how to proceed.
Come on, said Smirch. "Let's get the hell out of here. When do I start cutting in on the parties, huh? And when? is there gonna be this in it? He rubbed a thumb and forefinger together meaningly. Money? Exclaimed a state senator, shocked, pale. Yeah, money, said Powell, flipping his cigarette out of the window. And big money. He began rolling a fresh cigarette. Big money, he repeated, frowning over the rice paper. He tilted back in his chair and leered at each gentleman separately, the leer of an animal that knows its power, the leer of a leopard loose in a bird and dog shop. Ah, for God's sake, let's get someplace where it's cooler, he said. I've been cooped up plenty for 3 weeks. Smirch stood up and walked over to an open window, where he stood staring down into the street 9 floors below. The faint shouting of newsboys floated up to him. He made out his name. Hot dog! He cried, grinning, ecstatic. He leaned out over the sill. You tell 'em, babies! He shouted down. Hot diggity dog! In the tense little knot of men standing behind him, a quick, mad impulse flared up. An unspoken word of appeal, of command, seemed to ring through the room, yet it was deadly silent. Charles K. L. Brand, secretary to the mayor of New York City, happened to be standing nearest Smirch. He looked inquiringly at the president of the United States. The president, pale, grim, nodded shortly. Brand, a tall, powerfully built man, wants a tackle at Rutgers University, stepped forward, seized the greatest man in the world by his left shoulder and the seat of his pants, and pushed him out the window. My God, he's fallen out the window! Cried a quick-witted editor. Get me out of here, cried the president. Several men sprang to his side, and he was hurriedly escorted out of a door toward a side entrance of the building. The editor of the Associated Press took charge, being used to such things. Crisply, he ordered certain men to leave, others to stay. Quickly, he outlined a story which all the papers were to agree on, sent 2 men to the street to handle that end of the tragedy, commanded a senator to sob, and 2 congressmen to go to pieces nervously. In a word, he skillfully set the stage for the gigantic task that was to follow, the task of breaking to a grief-stricken world the sad story of the untimely, accidental death of its most illustrious and spectacular figure. The funeral was, as you know, the most elaborate, the finest, the solemnest, and the saddest ever held in the United States of America. The monument in Arlington Cemetery, with its clean white shaft of marble and the simple device of a tiny plane carved on its base, is a place for pilgrims in deep reverence to visit. The nations of the world paid lofty tributes to little Jackie Smirch, America's greatest hero. At a given hour, there were 2 minutes of silence throughout the nation. Even the inhabitants of the small, bewildered town of Westfield, Iowa, observed this touching ceremony. Agents of the Department of Justice saw to that. One of them was especially assigned to stand grimly in the doorway of a little shack restaurant on the edge of the tourists' camping ground just outside the town. There, under his stern scrutiny, Mrs. Emma Smirch bowed her head over 2 hamburger steaks sizzling on her grill, bowed her head and turned away so that the Secret Service man could not see the twisted, strangely familiar leer on her lips. The Greatest Man in the World by James Thurber. Countdown has come to you from the studios of Olbermann Broadcasting Empire World Headquarters in the Sports Capsule Building in New York. Thank you for listening. Here are the credits. Most of the music was arranged, produced, and performed by Brian Ray and John Philip Chanel. They are the Countdown musical directors. Produced by TKO Brothers. All orchestration and keyboards by John Philip Chanel. Guitars, bass, and drums by Brian Ray. Other Beethoven selections have been arranged and performed by the group No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2, and it was written by Mitch Warren Davis, courtesy of ESPN Inc.
Musical comments from Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Our announcer today was my friend Richard Lewis, and everything else was pretty much my fault. So that's Countdown for this, the 780th day since Donald Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Arrest him now while we still can. The next scheduled Countdown is Monday. Until then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again!
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five!
High Five!
Casino!
Casino!
Win at HighFiveCasino.com!
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.